Thank you for tuning into CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's hour-long news report, bringing you alternative and undercover current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Christina Song.
And I'm Ryan Patrick Jones. It's Thursday, December 7th at 5 p.m. We are broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Today we'll be listening to two exclusive reports by the Democracy Watch News Collective. First, a story of resistance and support for MARPOL's new temporary modular housing units. And then up next, an interview with UBC journalism student V.S. Wells about how board games are being integrated into elementary school lessons.
After that, News Collective member Rematullah Sheikh delves into the reaction from Vancouver's Zimbabwean Canadian community after the ouster of longtime President Robert Mugabe. But before that, headlines.
Nonpartisan Association is considering voting down capital spending in the 2018 budget. City councilors from the Nonpartisan Association are considering voting against capital spending increases proposed by Vision Vancouver for the 2018 budget. That's the portion of the budget for major projects like a new outdoor pool, social housing, and childcare spaces and roads. Councillor George Affleck from the NPA believes the city's increased spending on health and housing are misplaced and should be left to senior levels of government. This is the first time the NPA has had enough votes to veto a budget measure in the 10 years since Vision Vancouver came to power under Gregor Robertson. The party gained an extra councillor in the by-election won by Councillor Hector Bremer earlier this year, bringing the total to 4 out of 11. Capital spending increases require a two-thirds majority to pass. The fiscally conservative NPA is routinely critical of both property tax and city spending increases. The NPA councillors will make their final decision after hearing feedback from the community.
A hate crime witnessed by many but intervened by one. On Monday, December 4th, a 46-year-old man was arrested in connection with an alleged hate crime that took place on the SkyTrain. In a Facebook post, a Muslim woman named Noor Fadl described the incident, which occurred shortly after she boarded the train at the Waterfront station. The man, now identified as Pierre Balzan, began uttering verbal threats about her religion and attempted to physically force the woman's head toward his crotch. He also tried to grab her hijab, the scarf wrapped around her head, and he slapped her face. A bystander stepped in to protect Fadl. He left the SkyTrain and was arrested later while on another train. Fadl described feeling disappointed that in despite of there being many people on the SkyTrain, only one came forward to help.
A win for Kinder Morgan expansion project. The National Energy Board has ruled in favor of the Kinder Morgan expansion project as a way to bypass the Burnaby bylaws that have been delaying the project from moving forward. The ruling says that Kinder Morgan does not need to comply with two of the sections in the city's bylaws as they prepare for construction in the area. The $7.4 billion project is already months behind, and any further delays could threaten the chances of the project seeing completion.
Burnaby Mayor Derek Corrigan overtakes Gregor Robertson as chair of Mayor's Council. A ballot between the mayors of the different municipalities have voted in the mayor of Burnaby as the new head of the Mayor's Council, ending Robertson's three-year tenure as council chair. The vote has major implications for the future of transportation in Metro Vancouver, as the chair of the council is responsible for approving long-term transportation strategies, investments of TransLink, and appointing board members. Corrigan will assume his new role in early 2018.
Those were the headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We're going to take a short break and then hear some original reporting on a mounting controversy over the construction of temporary housing in MARPOL. Stay with us.
As UBC Africa Awareness Initiative is a student-run organization that advocates for a greater inclusion of Africa and African-related issues in UBC academia and social life. Some of our major events include Dioko, UBC's largest African dance party, Culture Night, a celebration of African culture and diversity, and Conference Week, where our goal is to foster more intelligent and intellectual dialogue about Africa on the UBC campus. With this in mind, we hope to contribute towards creating global citizens with a more informed perspective of the continent.
The UBC Concrete Canoe Team is a student engineering design team. Every year, we design, build, and race a canoe made entirely out of concrete. Whether you're in first year, fourth year, or anything in between, we would love to have you as a member. Check out our Facebook page, UBC Concrete Canoe, or our website, guessitfloats.com, for more details.
And we're back. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Christina Song. We just heard headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. We'll now turn to a report on Tuesday's protest in support over temporary housing units being built in Marpole. This story was reported on by Ryan Patrick Jones and myself, Christina Song, with editing and production assistance by Alex DeBoer.
The dispute over a temporary modular housing project for homeless people in Marpole heated up this week, with dueling protests staged at the corner of 57th Avenue and Heather Street. High school students, parents, and other community members gathered on the southwest corner of Sir Winston Churchill Secondary School on Tuesday morning for a new neighborhood welcoming rally. Rallygoers held signs declaring, "I am not afraid," and "You are welcome," to show support for the incoming residents of the city's second temporary modular housing project. The rally attracted upwards of 50 people, most of whom were students from local high schools. City Councilor Carrie Jang and poverty advocate Jean Swanson both attended to show their support for the cause.
Okay, so can you tell me your name?
I'm Ishmael Puyan.
Okay, and what brings you here today?
Just the responsibility that we have to make sure that the people that are coming in to the modular housing units feel welcome, and that's the number one priority of today, that we let people know that we're not afraid, that we're actually really excited to have them.
Okay, and so are you the founder of Marpole Students for Modular Housing?
I am one of the founders. We have a bunch of students working on this together, and we're just a big team that's working together on this.
And how did that begin?
It was actually in an IB geography class, and we were just sitting in class, and we came across a Facebook page that was called Marpole Students Against Modular Housing, and we're saying a few hateful things, and we just wanted to make sure that our perspectives were heard and that people knew that there were students that weren't afraid.
What brings you here today?
Well, I'm wanting to support the students because I think it's really important to encourage people who are homeless or underhoused to find welcoming places to come and live.
So are you impressed that it's the students organizing themselves today?
I think it's great. Yeah, I'm very proud of my daughter's one of the admins, and so, yeah, I'm really proud of them. I think they're doing a great job to help people feel welcome and understand the real issues behind what's happening.
Can you start by telling me your name?
Jean Swanson.
Hello, Jean Swanson. So what brings you here today?
So I live in Hastings Sunrise, and right close to two supportive housing places. And they've been there for about 3 years, and there's no problems.
Right.
So I just thought if I could add that reality to this conversation, it might be helpful.
And so why do you think people are opposed to something like this?
I think it's prejudice. There's a lot of prejudice against homeless people and low-income people.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what would you say to those people if you had a chance to talk to them?
I would say just what I just said, that I live in a neighborhood that has two supportive housing places and everything's fine.
Counter-protesters disrupted the welcoming rally, citing the dangers of housing homeless people who may be drug users across the street from an elementary school.
What brings you here today? Are you a Marpole resident?
Yes.
Okay, what brings you here today?
The reason is very simple. We don't want to see in the future and the students playground, and there's a lot of the broken glass And we don't want to see in the future, one day, the children in the school to be hit by the needles. So yes, a very simple reason.
So you're afraid of drug use?
Yes, right.
Okay, so why are you afraid of that?
Well, I can answer that because I don't think the city provided enough information for everybody to be sure that this site will be better. Okay, and the infrastructures that they organized, I can say it's very poorly. People's question never answered properly. And just ask people to give a blank check and say, okay, they'll be fine, don't worry about it, everything will be fine. And we will screen them, everything, and people asking about how do you screen them. Can we know what your questions are? We said, no, nobody can, this is confidential. So basically, I think it's a misunderstanding for people's fear.
So it sounds to me like you're talking about process.
The process is poorly handling, yes. I myself was a refugee too. I know what a homeless is, okay? Even myself, I know that. Everybody needs a shelter, for sure. But today's homeless, if you look at the history, it's more complicated than just a homeless without shelters, okay? They have a lot of mixed problems inside there. So.
But violence is not really one of them.
No. It's not the violence.
Like kidnapping.
I don't think so either.
Or anything like
that. No. That's too negative. See, the idea, everybody take that, is to helping the homeless
have
shelters. It's not that in my backyard, not in my schoolyard, okay? They can even build at my backyard, I don't care. But the schoolyard, yes, no.
So it's NIMSY, not
NIMSY. NIMSY. It's a NIMSY.
Democracy Watch reached out to the City of Vancouver to inquire about the selection process for residents of the temporary housing units. They responded via email saying, people who are unsheltered or living in shelters are being prioritized for these temporary housing units. The city also said that housing registry and tenants are selected through a coordinated process that ensures tenants' needs are well matched to the levels of services provided in the building. When asked whether any of the temporary housing residents have been convicted of violent crimes, the city responded that they are committed to managing the housing site safely and responsibly. According to the city, professional nonprofit housing operators have been hired to manage the temporary housing units.
Hey guys.
Thank you.
Go back to your regular.
Eventually, police and city employees arrived to enforce an injunction meant to prevent protesters from blocking housing construction.
Kids saved, kids in the week. I don't want any kids to get attacked, any kids to get hurt.
So basically, it says you're not allowed to impede construction, interfere with the access to and from the property. That's what it will. You'll get copies of all this.
Yeah,
okay?
I still can work, right?
Yeah, you can, but
yes.
It's just you're not allowed to block it.
Oh yeah,
okay?
No block, just work.
So as long as they remain a distance.
Tensions remain high as the injunction was enforced by police. One man vowed to continue blocking construction trucks, saying he was willing to be arrested for the cause. But he was eventually talked down by his fellow protesters and moved across the street, allowing construction to begin. This has been an original report by Democracy Watch, CITR's local alternative weekly news program. Thanks for listening.
That was a report by Ryan Patrick Jones, myself, and Alex DeBoer. Stay tuned to Democracy Watch on CITR. We'll be right back.
Do you want to know more about human rights abuses, global issues, and international politics? Are you interested in writing to foreign and local governments in response to global crises? Are you ready to give peace a chance? If your answer is yes, then Amnesty International UBC may be the club for you. Check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/AIUBC or send us an email at amnestyubc@gmail.com.
The UBC Concrete Canoe Team is a student engineering design team. Every year, we design, build, and race a canoe made entirely out of concrete. Whether you're in first year, fourth year, or anything in between, we would love to have you as a member. Check out our Facebook page, UBC Concrete Canoe, or our website, guessitfloats.com, for more details.
Welcome back to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We're joined by UBC journalism student V.S. Wells. V recently published a story in The Thunderbird about how BC's change to curriculum have opened the door to introducing board games in the classroom. Hi, V. Welcome to Democracy Watch. Before I ask any questions, could you summarize your recent Thunderbird story, Board Games Help Teachers Reach Bored Students?
Sure thing. So the BC legislature recently put through some changes that shifted the way that the curriculum works. They've changed it to revolving around six core competencies instead, and these changes came into effect for elementary school students last year. Since then, teachers have started using more creative methods to teach, and one of those is introducing board games into the classroom.
The inclusion of board games, you said, is part of the Ministry of Education's efforts to revamp their curriculum. What does this new curriculum look like, and what is core competency?
So instead of looking at dates and times and memorizing specific facts and figures, the Education Ministry want teachers to focus on teaching their pupils more skills. So the six core competencies which are in place are communication, critical thinking, creative thinking, positive personal and social identity, social responsibility, and personal awareness and responsibility. Basically, they're more skills-focused than fact-focused, and it's about trying to teach pupils to think in ways which can help them across a variety of different things, not just this is who won this battle when and that kind of thing.
It's curious that these up-and-coming educators are deciding to include board games in an era where everything, including the classroom, is becoming digitalized. Why do you think they have reverted to a medium that some may consider old-fashioned?
That's a really interesting question. Video games have been recognized as being part of education policy for a while now. The reason that I wrote about board games specifically is because I think they have something that video games don't have. They have a more immediate social connection. When you're sat around a table and you're playing with other people and you can see the whites of their eyes, you get something much more immediate. The other reason is because board games are actually a booming industry. Last year's sales figures from the industry body that monitors these things said that hobby game sales in North America had topped $1 billion. Of that, about $300 million had gone on hobby games, quote unquote. Those are the kind of big mass market boxes that you'll find in stores. And those are the kinds of games that teachers are now bringing into education, not just specifically education-focused board games.
Is there a trade-off, do you think, there from switching to a more interactive method of teaching from a more traditional way of doing things, such as loss in the amount of information?
So board games are being used to facilitate discussions or as like a jumping off point. It's not that teachers have thrown out all of their papers and books and are replacing everything with games. It's more like you're going to introduce a topic, maybe the War of 1812, and you go, here's a fun board game about the War of 1812. You may have a few copies or you may rotate, so you split your students into little groups and you get them to play this. Because of the theme of the game, it will give them an instant connection to the subject matter they're talking about, and then that gives them a way into it. So afterwards, the students might be like, huh, I wonder why this mechanic worked the way it did. And then that gives teachers a chance to go, yes, let's explore that in more detail and look into it.
So it's more supplementary rather than replacing.
Yeah, exactly. I think it'd be pretty difficult to build an entire course load around purely using board games.
Okay. How do you think the teachers view the shift in curriculum?
I spoke to four teachers, actually, in the Lower Mainland and a teaching candidate at UBC about this. All of them are really excited about what the core competencies are going to bring. They're excited that it's going to make teaching more flexible and creative and let them do their own things. The way that they want to include board games is basically to show off some of the different things that these games can do. And people are excited about it.
From your piece, it seems like you interviewed a lot of student teachers. What do you think their outlook is like entering the field?
Yeah, I spoke to Cynthia Hornbeck specifically. She is at UBC and she used to be employed by Fantasy Flight Games, which is a big board games company in the US. She is really passionate about this because she has seen board games from both sides, I guess. So pretty much everyone I spoke to is also a fan of the hobby. But Cynthia specifically has worked in the board games industry and has a viewpoint of what the industry wants to achieve. And then as a teacher, she gets to take all of those things that board games wants to do, like fostering social connection and doing different kinds of mechanical work and having a very strong theme. And she gets to bring that into a classroom and introduce it to students who wouldn't necessarily have come across it.
Okay. Thank you. That's all we have time for. And please stay tuned for an original report on Vancouver's Zimbabwean community and their reaction to the recent ouster of long-term President Robert Mugabe by News Collective member Ramatullah Sheikh.
Are you interested in Indigenous issues?
Are you down with decolonization?
Do you have something to say?
Or have a topic to share?
We have just the thing.
Join UBC's first ever Indigenous Radio Collective.
We're a team of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people.
I'm Niska from my mother.
From the Tahltan Territory.
I'm a settler from Washington State.
I'm from the Qualcomm and Musqueam First Nations.
I am Quechua Indigenous from Saraguro, Ecuador.
We broadcast from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land
of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Whatever you want to talk about, we're into it.
Everyone is welcome, no experience necessary. Unceded Airwaves airs Mondays from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Unceded Airwaves.
We want to hear your story.
Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. You are listening to Democracy Watch. Next, we have Ramatullah Sheikh on his piece on Robert Mugabe's ouster and its effect on the Zimbabwean community in Vancouver.
Sacked from his post, Mnangagwa has now returned from exile to form the new cabinet and lead a country that has been craving change and a new lease of life to its ailing economy. Everyone agrees that the new president faces an uphill task. But for now, the streets in Zimbabwe erupted with jubilation.
Mugabe must go and must go like yesterday. We can't wait to see his back.
For us, it's about a new beginning. For us, it's about the end of a tyrant rule. And we are going
thousands
to
of miles
back.
Away, the Zimbabwean the 21st diaspora of November 2017 signaled a new dawn for Zimbabwe. After holding on to power for 37 years over the southern African country, Robert Mugabe, the freedom fighter turned president, stepped down from office. The resignation came 6 days after the military took over the country and placed the 93-year-old leader under house arrest. Members of the parliament had already begun the impeachment proceedings against the president. But the resignation letter, which was later read out in public by the speaker, made their task easier. The man who now replaces Mugabe is Emmerson Mnangagwa. He was serving as the vice president of the country and was a close ally of Robert Mugabe up until early November, when he was mysteriously sacked from his post. Mnangagwa has now returned from exile to form the new cabinet and lead a country that has been craving change and a new lease of life to its ailing economy. Everyone agrees that the new president faces an uphill task. But for now, the streets in Zimbabwe erupted with jubilation. Thousands of miles away, the Zimbabwean diaspora in Vancouver and in the University of British Columbia closely tracked the developments back home. And when the longtime president finally stepped down, it was time to put the thinking caps on. The Africa Awareness Initiative hosted an event marked by discussions and debates on leadership and dictatorship in Africa, with focus on the path-breaking developments in Zimbabwe. The event was held at the Global Lounge in the University of British Columbia. On behalf of Democracy Watch for CITR 101.9 FM, I, Rahmatullah Sheikh, covered the event and spoke to the Zimbabwean community to understand their assessment of the current situation and their expectations from Zimbabwe's new journey. Of the main speakers at the event was Sharon Shamirera, a third-year MasterCard scholar at the University of British Columbia and the president of the UBC Africa Business Club. Here's Sharon talking us through what she felt was an empowering moment.
Over and over again, it always occurred that Mugabe would win, and it was like an unending cycle. So then came this coup from nowhere. I choose to call it a coup. It was a well-thought-out coup because they still don't call it a coup. When it all started, Mnangagwa being fired, then fleeing the country, and the military taking over, it was all happening really fast. I remember, like, I just gave up on my academics and studying. Like, I was just, like, on social media following it every day and trying to really understand what was going on. Like, I was calling my friends to theorize and talk about, oh, what if this happens? What if this happens? It was just a lot of excitement at the time when it all started happening. And I would call home and I would ask my mom, like, you know, what's the mood like at home? What does it feel like being at home right now? And there was hope. Lots of hope. Like, I could see it from when I would FaceTime my mom. So there was the big march. Like, thousands of people went out to the march. You know, my mom, for example, is not someone who usually goes out to things like political marches and everything. She'll talk about it. Like, she'll encourage other people. She'll be like, it's a good thing, you should go. And she'll never go. But, like, seeing her... but seeing my mom actually go out and come back from this march really energized and saying, you know, Mugabe is going to go. We're really, really excited. This is going to be a different Zimbabwe, a new Zimbabwe. It was really, really encouraging. You know, it was an empowering moment. Even here at UBC, students from UBC went downtown and they also marched and protested. And they all these people possibly did this because they all wanted to see Mugabe gone. They all had, I think we've all gotten to a point where, like, enough is enough.
We spoke to Sharon on the sidelines of the event.
What was the first thing that crossed your mind when you heard of the fact that he had stepped down finally after 37 years?
It was a lot of disbelief when I first heard, because I, you know, when you've been waiting for something for so long, and there'd been all this hype that, yes, he's going to step down. And we were just waiting, and there was nothing. And then I remember, like, he stepped down on Tuesday. On Sunday, Sunday evening, he gave a talk to the nation, and he just didn't say anything constructive. Like, it was a scheduled talk that everyone, and people thought he was going to step down then. And during the talk, he just kind of spoke about, oh, forgiveness, we're a Christian country, we need to move forward, we need to work on our country. And, you know, he just didn't say anything. So when I eventually heard that he stepped down, it was first disbelief, and then it was relief. It was a lot of relief and joy.
Did you see this coming then?
Did I see this coming? The coup? No. I think a lot of people may say, like, from the First Lady's, because the First Lady did a lot of... she spoke very negatively about the vice president at a lot of political campaigns. And this is something that she's done. She's always picked on people and spoken really negatively. So him firing the vice president was something really big, because the vice president has been really, really powerful. So I honestly didn't see it coming. And to think that Mugabe is now gone, like, even now, just thinking about the fact that he's no longer president, it's just really hard to believe. Like, yeah, I did not see this coming.
Two other students from the Zimbabwe diaspora on campus spoke to Democracy Watch. One of them is Tuwela Tembo, a student in the Faculty of Science. She shared her initial reactions to the news.
At first, I didn't believe it. Well, what happened was I woke up and then I checked my phone and there was a notification from BBC News saying Mugabe has resigned. And I just refused to believe it until my mother sent me a message on WhatsApp saying he has resigned. Then I believed it, and then I felt like crying.
For a few days, there had been talks of him resigning, but it was quite a long process. I mean,
that's Benjamin Chidzero, a second-year student in the Faculty of Arts. Benjamin had been tracking the spate of recent political developments in Zimbabwe closely. But even to his informed eyes, what transpired seemed almost unbelievable.
it was only 4 days, but it felt so drawn out because we were just refreshing the news the whole night long, and our essays and our homework went out of the window. It was just refresh the news. And then I woke up one morning. Of course, we've got the time difference of 10 hours, so that made a difference. It was hard to keep up with the news without sleeping. And I just refreshed it one morning, like Tuella, and it said he had actually resigned, and I thought maybe they got it wrong. It just, you know, the fact Mugabe resigning is something that Zimbabweans could not really fathom. It's something that we've thought about, but the way it went down was not the way anyone expected it to happen. It was such an unexpected series of events.
So is it safe to say that you guys did not see this coming?
Oh, definitely. I mean, people had talked about the fact that he was getting too old and there's no way that his presidency could continue, but we'd been saying that for 10 years. Since he was 83, people had been saying he's too old to be a president, and 10 years later, he was still there. So it had definitely been something that had been on people's minds, but people just couldn't believe that it actually happened.
The moments culminating into Mugabe's resignation may seem surreal, but now that the initial euphoria is behind the Zimbabweans and the day-to-day economic challenges still linger, they are assessing the future of the country and its new president with some caution. Here's Sharon speaking to the gathering.
So Mugabe resigns, Mnangagwa enters. He enters with the support of the people, because the people marched and they said they don't want Mugabe anymore, they want Mnangagwa. He comes into power with the backing of the army. He has the army, an entire military. They are willing to send Mugabe out, a man that they had served loyally for 37 years, and put this man, Mnangagwa, into place. So they're clearly, to me, it seems that their loyalty for this man knows no bounds. Like, they are very loyal to this Mnangagwa. So such power, from the way I see it, is very destructive if it is misused, because it makes me scared. In fact, it makes me really tremble, because if he's currently in a position where he just has so much power, and if he doesn't use it the right way, this could be, in my opinion, be worse than when we had Mugabe. So I have set my expectations really low, as you can tell. Like, I've set my expectations from Mnangagwa. I know a lot of people were saying, we've got a new daddy, it's so exciting. I've set my expectations really low, because I really want to be able to acknowledge the good things that he does when he actually does them. Because when I think about it, I go back to the ordinary Zimbabwean. All of this has happened and we're all talking about this in the international news, but the ordinary Zimbabwean is still trying to figure out how they're going to pay their electricity, how they're going to feed their family, like how they're going to pay school fees for their child. And so as long as the ordinary Zimbabwean is still thinking about that, even if we've got a new president, I find it difficult to see this as a celebration of like economic emancipation and all these big things that people are using, because the change is going to take some time. And it's going to mean that a lot of people are actually making the right decisions, they're actually putting in the work, and they just have to be willing to do that.
The phrase once bitten, twice shy rings true in politics and society. Tuella acknowledges the uncertainties that lie ahead, but like the people who celebrated on the streets of Zimbabwe, she's hopeful.
What do you think is next for Zimbabwe? What's coming up for them?
I think we're all just holding on to hope at the moment. We hope that Mnangagwa has learned from Mugabe's mistakes and he can at least fix them. But right now, I think it's too early to tell, because he hasn't even been in that position for a long enough time for us to be like, maybe you're doing stuff wrong already. But I'm hopeful. I mean, that's all I can have at the moment. I want to go home to a productive society, because that's what I work for.
The skepticism from students is not unfounded. While the resignation of Robert Mugabe comes across as a moment of reckoning and a new democratic path for the country, some argue that Zimbabwe's core challenges go beyond the need for a democratic template. Amongst the speakers at the event was Dr. David Morton. He is an assistant professor of African history at the UBC Department of History and his research interests include histories of urbanization and decolonization in southern Africa. Here's Dr. Morton explaining how Zimbabwe suffered rapid economic decline despite its democratic mandate in the early days of Mugabe's rule.
What had happened in Zimbabwe was that the negotiations that led to Zimbabwe's independence in 79, 80, independence was 80, but the negotiations were in 79, was that a sunset clause for white commercial farmers. That change in Zimbabwe would not mean the overnight nationalization and redistribution of land. Now, this was land that 100 years before was communal land, but with colonialism, most of the land was essentially appropriated by white farmers. And so we're talking about relatively recently in history, three, four generations before. And by the 90s, that sunset clause had lapsed. And Mugabe's coalition, as he had assembled it, began to teeter. And it began to teeter for reasons that democratically elected governments throughout Africa were challenged. They were challenged by the fact that they were heavily in debt. They were paying much of their budgets to the revenues to pay off loans that had been incurred under the encouragement, actually, of global financial institutions for development, development that didn't necessarily pan out. And now governments were suffering in their ability to provide, to pay salaries, government salaries, and to provide basic subsidies for food. So the democratically elected government of Zimbabwe faced this issue, and it didn't look like they were going to be able to hold on precisely because its main backers, which is to say the military and specifically veterans of the Liberation War, wanted what they thought was deservedly theirs, language that we're hearing now. The result was a decision to speed up land redistribution. So dealing with what was a great historical inequity, and initially carried out by democratic means, by a democratically elected government that was seeking to provide for its people in a troubled time, and that meant the occupation, the willy-nilly occupation of commercial farms throughout Zimbabwe, often to the benefit of veterans of the liberation movement. That was what led to the era of Bad Bob, as people often understand it, a time when those policies led to an absolute collapse of the agro-business, agro-commercial sector, and ultimately the rapid deindustrialization of Zimbabwe's economy.
With pressing economic challenges, Dr. Morton wonders if the openness of democracy in Zimbabwe really matters, provided that Mnangagwa and his regime somehow succeed in improving the agricultural sector and bringing food to the table. To break down these philosophical questions on the role of democracy, I spoke to Dr. Morton.
There are bigger picture questions about the link between a free and open democracy and economic security. And those two things frequently are unmoored. And so the comments I made were relative to, or the questions I was asking were relative to, how much is it that people actually want a free and open democracy? Is that really what people are seeking? Is that what people value? And it's a question about more than Zimbabwe. It's a question about a lot of things we're seeing around the world right now. About the, I don't want to say proliferation of illiberal democracy, because a liberal democracy has always been with us, and there's certainly no pure form of democracy that I would point to and say, that's what we all need to do. But nonetheless, I think there's no doubt we're at this moment, we're in a period when a lot of people are openly embracing strongman-type politics.
Yeah.
And what the events in Zimbabwe, how they speak to that, I think we have yet to see. Will Mnangagwa, who is of the strongman mold, be a strongman? Will that be a problem for Zimbabweans? If he's able to make other changes, that specifically economic changes.
I wanted to hear from the Zimbabwean community in Vancouver if living in a democratic society like Canada influences how they think their home country should conduct its political affairs. Sharon is on the fence with this question.
I think there are a lot of things that work well in Zimbabwe right now that I would love to see more of here in Canada. And there are a lot of things that work really well here in Canada that totally, honestly, always shock me that I would love to see a lot more of in Zimbabwe. So I think it's been nice to be able to have the different perspectives and to be able to say, okay, this is great. This would work. This works well here, and I think would probably translate well back home. But then there are things that work well back home that should probably be here too, that would translate well.
Here's Tuwela.
I would love for it to be like Canada in the sense of its organization. Things just seem to work. There's a system, and there doesn't seem to be much corruption. Like, there's no one who's just sucking up all the financial stuff that's coming from the people. So hopefully Zimbabwe can get to a point where we can be like this as well and trust the people in power to do what they're meant to be doing. And what's going through my mind right now is hopefully at some point we can all go home and better the society with what we're learning here, bring it to Africa, because really there isn't much in terms of development anyway. So we're hoping that with the information we're getting and the education we're getting, we can actually put it to use where it's needed the most.
The Zimbabweans on campus I spoke to said that with the changing tide in their home country, the role of the diaspora community in Canada is now more important than ever. Here's Benjamin.
Well, I think even on a wider scale than just Vancouver, we have Zimbabweans all over the world, and we have many, probably over a million Zimbabweans all over the world. And we have a lot of influence, I think, if we use it correctly. We have the internet. We can talk to people at home. We can give our perspectives, which have changed as we've come here. And a lot of the diaspora has economic wealth, not us, but some of the other Zimbabwean diaspora does have that kind of influence as well. And I think that influence, use it in the ways that you see fit, in the ways you see will benefit the country. And don't feel that just because you're thousands of kilometers away from Zimbabwe, you can't influence the country, because those thousands of kilometers don't matter in a modern world. And you have the power to influence it. And I would say, just stay connected, read the news. It's still your country. It's still something you need to care about. Don't forget where you came from, and keep up with the news, and you can influence the news if through whatever small means you choose.
Sharon believes that the diaspora will continue to keep a close watch on the new changes.
I think a lot of the diaspora community has really been pressing for Mugabe to go. But I think people are waiting to see what happens once Mnangagwa is in. They're really waiting to see before going back home. Like, I think a lot of people would like to go back home, especially people who are settled here. I think they would like to go home because there's no place like home. But it's also like it's a risk, right? So you want to make sure that by the time you're moving back home, the economy is thriving and there's room for that. And so when you move back home, you're kind of like settled and you're starting afresh, but you're starting to fresh in a place where there's hope and the economy is starting to rebuild itself. So I think people are waiting to see what happens before they actually move in.
Some, like Tuwela, cannot wait to go back home.
Do you see yourself standing a stronger chance of going back home after this change, something that you had not thought of earlier?
Definitely. The whole song before this happened was, you have to go to this country and you have to learn to like being there because you're going to be there for a very long time. But with this, hopefully, as soon as I'm done with my graduate degree, I want to leave. I want to go home. I want to be with my family. I want to be in the sun. I want to be happy again. Like, I want to go home. And with this happening, there's like, there's more hope for us because we all are like, okay, now there's something to go back home to. So let's all just go back and make it better for everyone.
Former President Mugabe served 37 long years. We asked Professor Morton how history will judge the enigmatic figure.
Robert Mugabe came on as the freedom fighter. He was fighting for liberation, but now he's leaving as a dictator who, in a way, outlived his role in the government. So how will history judge Robert Mugabe?
There's two ways to look at it. You can look at the personal politics and say, here was a corrupt autocrat that, through disastrous policies, ruined Zimbabwe's economy. Another way that future historians might look at it, and I can't really tell, but I can imagine a story going in another direction where you say Mugabe was one of many African leaders at the time whose options were very restricted after independence, who scrambled to seek political and economic solutions to deal with economic catastrophe that was not necessarily of their own making. In his case, the economic situation catastrophe became unimaginably worse because of government policies. That said, in the scheme of things, perhaps it is the story in the future might be told as good intentions gone bad of a leader who sought to right the inequities of the colonial past and land redistribution, and the experiment failed utterly, which is not to judge the wisdom of the policy, but to judge the unfairness of the past.
But the man that everyone, from students to political pundits, will closely evaluate now is not Mugabe, it's Emmerson Mnangagwa, who comes with a sea of expectations from his people. What is his mandate, and what does this signify for the Zimbabweans? Benjamin gives his take.
Well, I think the most important thing is we need true, free, fair elections next year. Mnangagwa has power until then, but he needs to make sure that he has and holds free elections, and if he loses, he steps down gracefully. That's something we haven't had for 37 years, and it's something, if he did that, he would have the respect of the people. He needs to distance himself from what has happened in the past more than he is doing so far. That's what one thing I would say. He's distanced himself a bit, but he does have those strong connections, and he has been a part of the ZANU-PF party that is Mugabe's party for so long, and we would hope that he would show that there is a new path. And my advice to him would be, he has 5 or 6 months as the president of the country, 5 or 6 months to impress the people of Zimbabwe. That's what he has. And if he does that, he might win that election, if he holds it. So that would be my advice to him. You have 6 months. This is your audition. This is the big question, is whether this, you know, some skeptical people, including myself, have said that maybe this isn't the great event that it's being purported as, and I've seen many news articles recently talking about that, saying maybe this isn't the great change that it's being portrayed as by a lot of people. But I think the thing is, as Zimbabweans, we've had nothing close to this for so long. I mean, I was born in 1997, so I was born not even Mugabe was already more than halfway through his time in presidency, so it's a big change, and that's what we haven't had for so long. It's people were allowed to protest on the streets. That the march that day was something that Zimbabweans had not experienced. And I was telling Tuwela that I was watching that, watching videos of that march and seeing people dancing and singing, and being allowed to protest was something so powerful. But also, who are they allowed to protest is the real question. If they were to protest the current regime, would they be allowed to? And that's how you know if you have real change.
Important questions that only time will answer. But for now, far away from their country, the Zimbabwean diaspora has already started the dialogue in an attempt to answer some of these questions. Africans and non-Africans came in large numbers to attend this event. So why are gatherings like this one at the Global Lounge in the University of British Columbia so important? Dr. Morton.
First of all, it is fantastic that the AAI does these events and that they get this huge turnout. I don't know lots of events on campus that get this kind of, not just turnout, but everyone is at the edge of their seats. I mean, you saw it. People want to engage on this issue, whether they're from Zimbabwe or not, or whether from Southern Africa or not. Frankly, whether they're from Africa or not. As for what happens, how something like this reverberates, is that, I think that's what you're going for. Like, what is it? I don't know. I think it doesn't need to reverberate. I think that the sort of the vibe of the room and all these thoughts passing back and forth among everybody, especially some of the Zimbabwean participants, a student who's Zimbabwean, for the past couple of weeks, at the beginning of class, I ask him to sort of fill us in, to give us his personal take on what's going on in Zimbabwe. And the eagerness that people have to talk things out. And I don't just, is there, and I don't just mean talk to make oneself heard. I think a lot of times people only are doing their best thinking. People do their best thinking, this is from my experience, when they're talking something out and where they're able to have a conversation, especially, because it's one thing to have a conversation with your family at home where everyone has a lot of knowledge they already have in common, a lot of understandings they already have in common. But there's a kind of exhilaration you get when you're able to talk to people who don't know the situation, and you get to be the person who talks to them about it. And moreover, you don't have the experience before of having to explain the things that you know so well to somebody else. And in this case, it's not just a matter of talking about all those things you do know and sharing it with people who don't, but it's a way of processing what's going on in a way that you're not used to. And so I think that's what, in the groups that I was circling and talking to, that's what I sensed, people processing it.
African students feel like they have a voice even on this campus, and that's great. And it's great to see different perspectives from people from different parts of the continent. And it also matters because it allows us to engage with this topic on an intellectual level, because a lot of the times as you're engaging with it with friends at home, where it's a lot of enthusiasm, but this allows us to really get into the nitty-gritties of what does this mean for us and what does it actually mean in a wider context of the world. What does it actually mean for the everyday Zimbabwean, and how have we seen this in the past, and like with different countries, and what does that mean for Zimbabwe moving forward? So it allows you to kind of piece in the bigger pieces of the puzzle.
This event was very important to me.
Here's Tobela.
Because personally, like, I get very emotional about Zimbabwe and the things that people have gone through. It's been very difficult for people. I've had moments where I'm like, will I even be here in the next few years because of the cash crisis going on back home? And, you know, politicians are just stealing all the money. They're driving all these amazing cars, traveling to all these amazing places, and there's people who are just struggling. Like, I've always told myself, I want to be able to live, not just survive. I've been surviving for so long. My family's been surviving for so long. I want to be able to enjoy actually being alive in my own country. So this event was very, like, close to my heart, because I was like, people need to know what's happening and what's happened and why we're so happy. And, you know, hopefully this can be, like, the one moment that just changes everything. And, yeah, definitely I would like for more African talk around campus and around Vancouver, because I feel like people are still very closed to that. Maybe they don't care, or maybe they just don't know, but I would like to bring this to their attention so that they know that people like us exist, and we want to educate the people, and they should feel free to come out and, you know, join us in these conversations.
Zimbabwe and its infamous hyperinflation often make it to books of economics. But sensing the mood at this event at Global Lounge here at the University of British Columbia, it seems like Zimbabwe finally is turning a new page in the books of history. This was our special report on the political developments of Zimbabwe and the response of the community in Vancouver. I am Rahmatullah Sheikh, and you've tuned into Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM.
Hello, welcome back. This is Rahmatullah Sheikh, and that was me reporting from the Global Lounge at University of British Columbia. We are now joined by Benjamin Chidzero. He is a second-year student in the Faculty of Arts here at UBC. Benjamin was born in Zimbabwe and moved to Canada to attend university. Welcome, Benjamin. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm first going to ask you, so I spoke to Professor Morton, who we heard over the radio right now, and he told me that there's this one student in class who he has assigned to become like this correspondent from Zimbabwe to give us daily updates from the place and fill in the students. So I'm guessing he was speaking about you, wasn't he?
Oh, well, yeah, I have been playing that role in the class, and it's an interesting one to have. And it's also been one I've been having with anyone I tell I'm from Zimbabwe. They're also interested in what's going on, and it's great to have that opportunity to have people caring about where I'm from and share what I'm saying, share the experiences that we're all having. And it's been a great role to have, and I'm really happy that people are so interested in what's going on at home.
Yeah, well, let's bring the classroom in here now. It's been 2 weeks, or a little over the 2 weeks, since Mugabe stepped down. So what are the new developments?
Well, we've had the new cabinet announced by Mnangagwa, and people were a bit worried by that at first because we saw a lot of, you know, people who were involved in Mnangagwa's military connections being put into power, and that worried a lot of people because, you know, we don't want to be seeing these kind of power politics where friendships are given power positions. That's what we tried to get rid of with Mugabe. We don't want to be seeing that from Mnangagwa. And people made that clear to him, and we did see a slight reshuffling of that cabinet with two positions given to more successful, more acceptable candidates, and that was good to see. And then we got the finance minister just released a budget today, and people seem very happy with that. We have a lot of money allocated to education, not too much allocated to the military, which is what some people were worried about, given Mnangagwa's military connections. So far, things have been good. We're all worried because a lot of us know Mnangagwa's history, but so far he's showing good things. It's only a few weeks into his presidency, and obviously you have to be careful with that, but we're definitely excited. It seems like we're getting some real tangible change, and the country's in a good direction for the first time in a long time.
Yeah, right. Well begun is half done, they say, but not too sure how much that holds true for politics. Tell us a little bit about the reaction of people in Vancouver. What's the kind of conversation that people, especially non-Africans and non-Zimbabweans, having about this whole issue?
Well, it was interesting. I could tell that a lot of people had just read a headline because I had people coming to me asking about a military coup in Zimbabwe and whether my family was safe. And if you actually read the news stories, you would know that this was very non-violent military coup, and the general citizens of the country were completely unharmed. So it showed me how many people read headlines and don't read the news articles, which was interesting to me. But still great to have people intrigued enough to be asking me about it, and I was able to clarify on that a little bit for them. But definitely interesting to see that people would see African military coup and immediately think of it as a violent threat to my family, whereas that was never something that I saw it as. And so that was an interesting dynamic to have, in that maybe what the news was portraying it as at first was not what I was getting from home, and I was able to give people that different perspective, which felt good to be able to help people out with the at least my perspective and my family's perspective as something which I saw as more accurate than maybe what the news got at first. They definitely have been more accurate later on.
Yeah, Benjamin, when I spoke to you at the event, you said that this is the phase of audition for Emmerson Mnangagwa. So tell us a little bit more about that. It's sort of an interesting phrase that you used.
Well, I called it an audition in the hopes that we do have elections next year, because these were scheduled already, and just because Mnangagwa has taken power does not mean that these elections shouldn't be happening. They were scheduled, and they should go on as they were expected to. And I called it an audition for him because, I mean, these are the months. He's got 7 months in power to show us what he can really do as a president. And if his policies are good, if he seems to be creating a more democratic, a freer society, a society where we're able to speak about what we want, what change we want, we're able to criticize the government and see changes building up from our criticisms, then I think he's got a higher chance of winning the elections. And that's why I called it an audition for him. And I hope that he, even if it is an audition, he carries through with what he does in that audition period after that period as well.
Yeah, this is sentiment that I caught at the event as well. There seems to be a lot of reservations despite this watershed moment in Zimbabwe. Where do these reservations really stem from?
Well, if you read up about Mnangagwa, he's been closely connected to Mugabe's party for a long time. He's been minister of various ministries within the government over time, and he's got other dodgy deals in his history. He's in his inauguration speech, he said he wanted to get rid of all corruption in the country. But then you go to, there's a UN document from 2002 which implicates him in diamond dealings in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, so-called blood diamonds, and, you know, someone saying they want to eradicate corruption in their country should come out and address those kind of reports first, I think. And we can't ignore Gukurahundi, which I don't think was mentioned in your report, but it was, the numbers are vary, but it was the systematic killing of Ndebele people in the Matabeleland province in the early 1980s, just after independence, because there were two factions of the government, you know, vying for power. And Mugabe sent Mnangagwa as the army general that he was into that area, and he actually orchestrated a lot of that genocide to crush opposition in the Matabeleland province. So it's those kind of, you know, those historical, we can't judge him by his history. If he's a good president, we'll have to accept that and move on from that. But that's why we all have our reservations. Despite what he's shown so far, which seems to be good, we can't ignore that.
Yeah, Benjamin, are you seeing Zimbabwe in a new light now? Are you really looking forward to going back home and seeing the country which may have changed slightly at least?
Yeah, I'll be going back in the summer, which will be the winter over there, and I'm very excited. It's been it'll be 2 years at that time since I've been home, and hopefully so much has changed, and I'm definitely excited to see what my country is becoming.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Benjamin, for shedding some more light on what's happening back in Zimbabwe, an important story and something that we'll be tracking closely too.
And thank you for your report. I thought it was excellent.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Benjamin. Thank you so much for joining us again. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We were covering some alternative and undercovered current events. For the next week, we have a special report on the Vancouver Palestinian reaction to the American acknowledgement of Jerusalem as Israel's capital next Thursday. Tune in at 5 p.m. I am Rahmatullah Sheikh. Good night and stay tuned for more CITR programming.